The Spectator podcast is brought to you by Berry Brothers and Rudd.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be looking at the rebirth of the Scottish Tories. We'll also be asking whether it's helpful to call Marine Le Pen a fascist. And finally, we'll be considering what the future holds for Britain's opposition parties. On to our first item, the strange rebirth of Scottish conservatism. Almost 20 years ago, the party was almost wiped out by Tony Blair. But now, the polls are suggesting that the Tories may take a third of the votes in Scotland. So, what's behind this? And how seriously should we be taking the polls? I'm now joined by Ruth Davidson, the leader of the Scottish Conservatives, and Fraser Nelson. So, Ruth, what's going on?
Well, I think, first of all, what I'd say is these are some great polls that we've had in, but polls aren't votes. We're going to work really, really hard until the general election to make sure that we make good on our promise. But I think we have got some very strong indicators. For example, in the Scottish elections last year to the Holyrood Parliament, we more than doubled our share of the votes. We doubled our number of seats up from 15 to 31. We leapfrogged Labour, put them in third place for the first time in 60-some years, and became the official opposition in Scotland. Now, I'm pretty ambitious for the party, so that's not really good enough for me. I've got to now turn us into a government in waiting. But it does show that there is a genuine and sustained recovery, and we've got the local government elections in Scotland that are happening right now. We'll get the results of those pretty soon, and we'll be able to show it again that we need to get Conservative representatives in every community in Scotland.
Fraser, what do you make of this rise of conservatism in Scotland?
Well, it's funny that conservatism was, as you say, proclaimed dead in Scotland pretty much in Tony Blair's landslide in 97. And when I was working in the Scottish Parliament about 5 years later, the Tory MSPs were joking they should rename the party the effing Tories, because that's the only way they were known by it in much of Scotland. And then there were all these attempts to revive the corpse that seemed to have failed. And even in the general election a couple of years ago, even under, Ruth's acclaimed leadership, they got 15% of the vote in Scotland, even less than 1997. So what we've seen is a long period of almost lifeless Scottish conservatism, followed by this huge revival. Now, politics is moving very fast everywhere right now, in Europe, in America, and in Britain. And it seems to me as if the Scottish Tories are benefiting from two things. One is the collapse of the Labour Party, which is extraordinary. And to see Glasgow go to the SNP, as it probably will in the local elections, is extraordinary. And the other is the Nicola Sturgeon's perhaps unwise decision to put a second referendum back on the agenda so clearly. Now, Scots who lived through the referendum campaign in 2014 and don't want to do it again have got to make a decision who is most likely to stop that referendum from happening, Jeremy Corbyn or Theresa May. Now, that is an easier question to answer than it would have been the other questions that Scots Tories have been asking themselves. So I think what's happening is the Tories are becoming what they used to be before 1960 in Scotland, the Unionist Party, only this the party the British rather than the Irish Union.
Well, I think actually I would pick up a couple of points there, because I don't think that gives a true story of what's been happening on the ground in Scotland. And Fraser talks about the general election in 2015 and our share of the vote going down to sort of 15.5%. Now, our recovery started before that. There are very specific issues that happened in that election. There was this enormous surge, because it was 6 months after the independence referendum, where we saw, seats swept away across Scotland. We saw 40 out of 41 Labour seats across Scotland be swept away. And there was a putative attempt to tactically vote in some areas in Scotland. Now, with us only holding one seat, we weren't often the receptacle for tactical voting to be put in. So I would say that actually our vote share in 2015 was artificially depressed. If you kind of go into the gubbins of previous election results and where we've been building from since I became leader back in 2011. But what I would say as well, when Fraser talks about the collapse of the Labour Party, there does seem to be an acceptance or a belief now that the Labour Party everywhere in the UK is gubbed, and therefore Scotland's just a natural byproduct of that. If I would again point to the Scottish election last year, now on the same day as Scotland went to the polls for Holyrood, you also had the mayoral elections where Labour won seats in, you know, in Bristol, got the mayor there. It took back London under Sadiq Khan. You saw local government elections in a third of the country in England, where they held pretty much steady. Again, in Wales, they stayed remarkably still in government, still the biggest party after, I think this is five parliamentary terms. So this idea that it was a universal collapse actually isn't true, and the numbers don't bear that out. I mean, I think post the second Jeremy Corbyn leadership challenge and some of the difficulties that the Labour Party's having and is being exposed in this general election, it seems as if it was ever thus. But actually, last year wasn't universally a bad result for the Labour Party, but it was catastrophic in Scotland. So it's maybe a precursor to a general Labour collapse rather than a symptom of one that's UK-wide.
Ruth, the message we keep on hearing down here from the Tories is about strong and stable leadership, but it seems like there's quite a different message being given to people in Scotland. Is it fair to say that the Tories have become more a party of unionism than conservatism?
Well, I think one of the big differences now is the fact that we've assumed the position of leader of the opposition and the party of opposition. Actually, you get both. So, yes, there is a big nationalist unionist divide in Scotland, and it's, I think, to the eternal detriment of Scotland that the divisions of the referendum in 2014 have remained open. And I think that's why, for example, you're seeing things like Scotland is one quarter away from recession, while the rest of the UK is actually growing and there's economic growth there. And there's a number of economic indicators in Scotland that buck the trend of the whole UK. But there is also now a challenge that's about centre-right versus centre-left. Now, we've not had that in post-devolution politics in Scotland. So when you're talking about, you know, making sure that we have a competitive tax rate in Scotland, now that taxation is one of the issues that have been devolved in the last year to the Scottish Parliament, we've got different income tax rates in Scotland than there are down south. The thresholds are different. So you're seeing this divergence, and now you're beginning to see emerge in the way that when Fraser was working up here, you just didn't have it. When you had a soft left consensus between Labour and the SNP, it was always about spending. It was never about how you raise the money in which you spend and support services. So that's quite an embryonic debate to have. I mean, we've been the major opposition party now just for a year, just slightly less than a year, but that's something that's going to change immeasurably. But you're absolutely right, there's two different election campaigns running both north and south of the border. Down south, it's about who is going to lead the government. Is it going to be Prime Minister Theresa May or Prime Minister Jeremy Corbyn? And elements of that are part of this debate in Scotland. But the major debate in Scotland is how does Scotland, which has a majority of people that support staying part of the United Kingdom, but has an overwhelming majority of political voices at Westminster saying that only thing Scotland wants is to break away. How do we start that fight back against the SNP? And I want to lead Scotland's fight back against the SNP at these elections.
Well, the left versus right question is a fascinating one. And the Conservatives down here are watching amazed as their party does well, not just in Scotland, but in Wales, where one poll put them on course to win half of the seats in Wales. First of all, they're very happy that it seems that the Tories, who had been written off as a kind of England-only party not so recently, are now able to get back into the Celtic fringe. But the question is, what is creating the rout? What is making this happen? Now, is it because voters are more receptive to centre-right arguments, or is it something else? Might the Brexit vote, rather referendum, have scrambled allegiances in Britain, making it possible for the Tories to take Labour areas? The 2014 a referendum in Scotland also scrambled allegiances. That's what referendum do, because people tend to get more attached to the position that you can referendum rather than how they voted in the general election.
I think there's something in that, Fraser. I really do. And I think one of the things that we've learned now about binary decisions like referenda is that they put people into two separate camps, and that cuts across traditional party lines. So it does, in a sense, sort of shake up the snow globe. But I think probably, in terms of being an observer from here, looking at the rest of the UK, I think that actually a lot of the decisions that are being made down south in this election are about leadership. And I think as well that we don't have a presidential style of democracy. That's not how our parliament is set up. But you can be, you know, pretty sure that the twin-track approach of who is strongest in terms of the party leader that's going to be a putative prime minister, and who's strongest in terms of the economy and more trusted, are the two biggest indicators of how people will vote at an election. And at the moment, the Conservative Party across the UK is more trusted on both of these than Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party is. And I don't think that that's cephalogical idea that the people who own these two areas go on to win look like they're going to be challenged at this election.
You mentioned the presidential aspect there, but one of the things I've been struck by when I'm looking at the Tory leaflets, what messaging are you guys using in Scotland to make arguments? A lot of it seems to be you personally rather than the Conservatives, in the same way that Theresa May is campaigning on her own name with the Conservative Party as second. But also the arguments basically, we said no, we meant it, vote Tory if you don't want there to be a referendum. I'm trying to work out to what extent the Conservative brand is being revived or whether it's other factors.
Sure, I mean, I think in that front, I mean, not to dwell on things that are going on right now, but we've learned partly because of 2015 that what we thought we knew about what counted as local campaigning and what counted as national campaigning has been slightly blurred by the Electoral Commission. And therefore, you know, in terms of having national spend that goes to houses right across the country, that has to have national messaging. It has to have either the Prime Minister, if it's UK-wide, or me on it. And that can't include the names of your candidates. It can't include, so for example, at these local government elections, what we would do in individual councils, because that counts against your local spend. So we've got to be very clear about what is a national message and what is a local message, just to make sure we keep our noses clean in terms of the campaigns themselves. So absolutely, we have stuff that's out across the country that's got a big national message about standing up to the SNP. But we also, in individual constituencies and in council wards for the council elections, have literature that's going out from our local council candidates talking about what they would do in administration and town halls in their patch of the world. But we've got to keep those separate. I run my own campaigns here. You know, we're completely not associated with some of the other issues that have gone down, that have gone on elsewhere. But that doesn't mean I'm not cognisant of making sure that we keep on the right side of the rules.
Well, Ruth's right to say that the Scottish Conservatives do run their own campaigns, but quite often the attacks they get from the opposition are to do with UK government policy. I've been fascinated listening to the Scottish debate about to hear this phrase rape clause come back again and again. Now, this refers to a British government policy to deny tax credits to mothers who've had more than two kids unless the child is the product of rape. Now, this is a very controversial clause, but Jeremy Corbyn never raises it. You only ever hear it when the SNP is using it to attack the Scottish Conservatives. So I'm wondering, Ruth, if you think that you've got it a bit tougher because you are subject to a better quality of opposition than Jeremy Corbyn is able to apply to Theresa May's party.
Well, I think that there's a specific issue for that one policy on the grounds that at the time at which it was going through the House of Commons back in 2015, it was during the period that Harriet Harman was the interim leader of the Labour Party, and she instructed her MPs to abstain on the issue rather than vote against it. So I think that's one of the reasons why it's not being raised by the UK-wide Labour Party in the same way as it's being raised by the SNP, who did vote against it at the time. But yes, I mean, there are questions when it comes to a general election about the government of the UK more generally. And there is also the aspect of the SNP, who very successfully, I think any observer would suggest, ran as a government in Scotland for 10 years, but run that government as an opposition to Westminster. So all of their literature is sort of othering the UK, the Tories, the, you know, all of these other things, and talking about Scotland versus the Tories. We even had a cabinet minister stand up at their conference in March saying, you know, this fight is about Scotland versus the Tories, and this time Scotland is going to win. And I had to gently point out to the gentleman concerned that, you know, in May of last year, over 500,000 Scots voted Tory. So we're not an other anymore. And one of the issues from being wiped out in 97 was that our opponents were allowed to write our history for us. And there was a lot of othering that went on. And part of the long road back has been about making sure people understand that we're working hard in communities all over the country. And that's why, actually, these local government elections, I'd already committed a huge amount of resource to, because I see them as actually the key to our sustained comeback in Scotland, because it's about making sure that in communities right across Scotland there are Conservatives in and working on the ground. And if you know someone and you see the work that they're doing and you see the commitment that they have and the service that they give, it's very difficult to other them in the way that has been allowed to happen when we've been in absentia in all these different communities.
Just finally, what do you both see as a good result for the Tories in Scotland this election?
Well, basically, more than one MP would be quite a good result for the Conservatives. But I don't know, there's talk of Murray, Angus Robertson, the SNP leader. The SNP has held that seat for quite some time, hasn't been Tory for three decades. I think that would be the worry-you-up-for-Portillo moment for the Scottish Conservatives if they would get Murray. But I suspect Ruth would not dare predict that she'd go that far.
Well, I might only be 38, but I'm a veteran, a veritable veteran in Scotland when it comes to elections. I think this general election is my seventh I've led the party into. And I have been asked at every single election what I would consider a good result, and I've always declined to comment. My team know the ambitions that I set for them. They know what I consider and what our work is towards, but I'm not about to share it with a Spectator podcast. My apologies.
That was Ruth Davidson and Fraser Nelson.
If you've always wanted to start a wine cellar, 2017 could be the perfect time. Barry Brothers and Rudd's cellar plan is designed to suit all tastes and budgets. To find out more, visit bbr.com/cellar plan.
Now on to our second topic. What does the term far right mean? With the progress of Marine Le Pen to France's presidential runoff, the term has been liberally used, as it has been over recent years across the West. But has the term lost all meaning? I'm now joined by Douglas Murray, the author of The Strange Death of Europe, and David Goodhart, Head of Demography at Policy Exchange and the author of The Road to Somewhere. So I suppose let's start with a definition of the far right. Douglas, what do you mean by the term far right?
Well, I mean, and I think everyone used to mean, a fascist, a Nazi, neo-Nazi, somebody who, for instance, didn't really believe in the democratic process, didn't mind the use of political violence or violence to achieve political ends, and a whole set of really really nasty, ugly opinions behind that. Racism, you know, all sorts of extremism. And I think most of us sort of knew what it meant. It was somewhere in that territory. Now, I think it is used very largely, as I say in this piece, by people for partisan political ends to smear and defame many people who I think should not be given the term. And the problem is, I think, that it is polluting our political discussion, and it's particularly polluting it across Europe, where it's not just that politics is on the march and the move, but the publics are clearly on the move. And that in such a situation, it's very dangerous simply to call everything you don't like far right, because if you do call everything you don't like far right, you end up, strangely, allowing the far right in.
David, what do you see the term for?
Well, I agree with most of that, and I've heard far too many people just in the last few days talking, describing the Front National, for example, as far right, as fascist, actually. We had Dominic Wazzy doing it at the Spectator event. I heard Bernard-Henri Lévy doing it at a Henry Jackson Society event. I heard on Newsnight last night Yanis Varoufakis calling the Front National fascist. And as Douglas says, this is far too easy. It means that a whole section of the left and the centre-left, you know, liberal Europe, stops addressing the issues that these parties are winning a lot of support on. We simply do not acknowledge the extent to which some of these parties have changed their spots. And we're very asymmetrical on this. We're very happy to, you know, how many was it? You know, four or five people who sat in Tony Blair's first cabinet were former Trotskyists. Mm. We're happy to allow people to come in from the extremist cold on the left. We've historically tended to be much more reluctant to do it to people on the far right. You know, they're moving, but it's only an apparent move. You know, they retain their deeply embedded commitment to racism or anti-Semitism or whatever it is. Some people will be doing that. They will be disguising it. But I think we have to acknowledge that other people genuinely change.
Douglas, why do you think the term far left is less toxic than the term far right?
Gosh, it's an interesting question. A historical anomaly, apart from anything else. But if you want to regard how strong that anomaly remains, I mean, you consider that on May Day this year, the shadow chancellor, John McDonnell, gives a speech in Trafalgar Square in front of banners with Stalin on them. I mean, the idea that Philip Hammond would ever speak at a rally in Trafalgar Square in front of banners of Goering or Goebbels, I mean, it's unimaginable. I think it might come down slightly to the thing that Robert Conquest spotted years ago. He said that just that there seemed to be something just worse about Nazism than about Soviet communism. It may have something to do with that. It may just be that the left has been more tolerant of people going on the move politically. My own suspicion is simply that for a whole variety of reasons in recent years, it's become one of the few things in politics which is fixed. You know, our politics is in real flux and has been for a very long time. And one of the few things we could all agree on in the political mainstream was that we didn't like the far right. And that gave us something to orient ourselves around. You know, and say, I say in the piece, like Cavafy's famous poem about the barbarians, waiting for the barbarians, you know, when they don't come, you know, they gave us a purpose of a kind. They gave us a meaning. And I think to some extent you could say that that was the case with the far right. But I can't really answer the question. It's such a, as I say, from that McDonald example, such a crazy oddity.
I mean, and you rightly talk in the piece about how, I mean, to be more specific on the Front National, I mean, just how much they have changed in a whole set of policy areas and sort of philosophy too. I mean, they now, I mean, you know, the Front National, like so many of these parties, do emerge from pretty murky waters. There's no question about that. Nobody is denying that for a moment. But they have emerged. You know, they are now a party that supports laïcité. I mean, the whole anti-Semitic Catholic tradition, anti-Dreyfus tradition, was not to embrace laïcité. They now embrace laïcité. They talk about culture rather than race. They talk about being opposed to Islamism rather than Muslims. I mean, they've modified not only their policies, but their whole philosophy. And you've had a lot of people coming into the party from the more mainstream right parties, and that has had a modifying and civilising influence on them. And if we are not to respect and welcome that, and indeed, you know, if for our own political purposes, we need to go on calling them fascists and far right, that is very unfortunate.
Do you think the fact that Marine Le Pen has now stood as an independent and separated herself from the Front National suggests that she recognises there's a kind of toxicity to it?
If she does recognise that, it can't have been a recent recognition. I mean, she's lived with it all her life. No, I think she's just trying to reflect Macron's significant advantage of being able to say in an anti-political age that I am not a party, there is not a mainstream sort of thing pulling me back, as it were. I don't think there's much more to the Le Pen's move than that. But just kind of at that point, I mean, you know, if somebody politically, you know, ends the career of their father for something, is it of no significance or is it of some significance? I think it's of some significance, whilst remaining very sceptical, as I think everybody should be, of a move by a party like the Front National, saying, you know, we won't be satisfied with simply token gestures or anything like that. But it must matter a bit. I mentioned in the piece another example. The difference between, for instance, a party that is openly racist, I'm thinking of Jobbik in Hungary or the Golden Dawn in Greece, and a party which is not racist but may, for instance, be discovered to have racist members. Or the difference between a party that has racist members and loves it and a party which, when it discovers it has racist members, kicks them out. Now, these seem to me to be very, very crucial divides. And yet, all of the people that are lumped in as far right would encompass all of those things.
So an anti-immigration party, by definition, is not far right.
No, I give the example in the piece of the Sweden Democrats, who I think are almost always described as far right. And from simply, you know, speaking to people in the party for the course of the book I've been writing and seeing their events, I came to the conclusion that they should be regarded as being within the political mainstream. They are anti-mass immigration, but I did not think that they were a far-right fascist party.
No, I mean, so the Conservative Party is anti-mass immigration. I mean, it's a perfectly legitimate position to hold, and of course this is part of the problem. I mean, the word populism, for all of its sort of looseness and slackness, is in some ways a more useful one here. There are populist parties and there are far-right parties. I think the Front National, UKIP and so on should be described as populist parties. And the thing about populism, as you know, as many people who study it point out, is that populism is utterly mainstream in our political culture. I mean, wariness towards elites. I mean, you know, it's built into the US Constitution, you know, the separation. Why do we have the separation of powers? Because we're suspicious of people accumulating too much power. You know, the idea that you should put the interests of your own citizens before the interests of citizens from other countries. Absolutely kind of mainstream idea. That populists take these ideas that are mainstream, but they take them more seriously than liberals do. I think the other problem here is definitions of racism. I mean, you might say that a lot of politics now is about how you define racism and even nationalism. Now, we can all agree that, or rather I would say conservatives and centrists agree that racism is about hostility towards, contempt towards outsider groups of various kinds, religious or ethnic. Now, liberals and people on the left will also obviously accept that definition, but they want a wider definition that includes too strong an attachment to your own group, or your own nation, indeed. And obviously it is possible to have too strong an attachment to your own group. That's why we have the rule of law and anti-discrimination rules and so on and so forth. But it's in that kind of fuzzy area of what is legitimate. You know, is the idea of white flight, feeling discomfort and living in an area which becomes dominated by a group other than your own, and you move out or you move your children out of a school, is that racist behaviour? Or is that a legitimate sense that your way of life has been changed too rapidly? I mean, you know, this is where the argument now is, I think.
In your book, David, you talk about the anywheres and the somewheres. Do you think it's fair to say that the term far right has actually become quite dated and isn't really as applicable these days?
I think, as Douglas was saying, I think the far right still has some uses. I mean, there are some groups that would be legitimately described as far right.
You know, probably Combat 18 or something.
Yeah, like yeah. That, or Jobbik, as you were saying. Jobbik, exactly. And Golden Dawn, you know, who are overtly racist, who are street organisations in some ways, you know, and who are not Democrats and who use violence, and who think it's legitimate to use violence as a political end. That doesn't apply to, you know, the what's the main populist party in Denmark, or
the Danish People's Party.
The Danish People's Party, the Sweden Democrats, UKIP, the Front National. I mean, there are variations obviously even within that, and they come from, I mean, most of the populist parties either tend to have kind of extreme right roots, like the Front National, or the kind of nutty professor roots, I mean, like UKIP or Alternative für Deutschland, you know, these are, you know, a bunch of professors who took some rather technical issue, constitutional or currency issue, and then support poured in from elsewhere, as it were. You have very different roots for these parties. So I don't think we want to chuck out the term far right completely. We just need to use it with some discrimination. And if parties change pretty fundamentally, then we should acknowledge that change and not stick to it. But as we were saying, there's a political purpose behind wanting to use the label as widely as possible. And we see precisely the limits and the danger in doing that in Sweden, where the political class, more than anywhere else probably in Europe, Douglas knows more about this than I do, but more than anywhere else in Europe, they have tried to cordon off the main populist party, the Sweden Democrats, which does indeed have pretty horrible far-right roots, but has moved a very long way, but it continues to be outcast. So even with the latest outrage, whenever it was, 2 or 3 weeks ago in Sweden, all the other political parties were invited in to discuss it, and the Sweden Democrats were left out in the cold again. The Sweden Democrats are now leading in the public opinion polls in that country, and it has allowed, I think, the Swedish political class not to address the issues that is disturbing so many voters who are now looking to the Sweden Democrats for an answer. And that is very sad, that we have to have a party of, if not the far right, you know, the populist right has to be the only representative of Swedish people on these mainstream issues.
One other thing which comes from this is, if you keep on saying that everyone is far right, I think I mentioned at the very beginning, you know, it means that particularly younger people are likely to be sceptical of the idea that anyone who is called that is. So, I mean, as I say, you risk the possibility in a country like Sweden, where people say, you know, of course X, who I know who votes Sweden Democrat, or Y, who I know who'd like to stand for the party, isn't a fascist. And then when you call, you know, another person you don't know a fascist, I say, particularly young people, I think, are suspicious of it, like the throwing around of the term racism or anti-Semitism.
Exactly.
In bad. And there's one answer to this, by the way. I mentioned this in my book, that there's an answer to this that's very obvious in the short term, which is that there should be a similar societal punishment, as it were, for using these terms knowingly erroneously, as there is for the crime itself. In other words, that if you go around calling people racist who are clearly not racist, you should be deemed to be as, you know, sort of ugly and dishonest in your politics as somebody who is a racist. If you go around saying that person is far right simply because it's convenient for you politically, instead of getting away scot-free from it and saying, well, it doesn't matter, and sort of brushing the facts away if they ever land, that person should themselves be seen to be equally destructive of the democratic process.
In your definition, Douglas, you mentioned people being opposed to democracy as being fascist, but you could say that being anti-populist is being anti-democracy. Is that the same problem?
Well, I don't like the term populist. I don't use it. I think it's become a word that, again, is close to meaning very little. there are people who defined it, as long as you know what terms you're speaking, what it is you define it as, then it's okay. But I think populist has simply become, for some people, anything that's popular. There are obviously certain traits of populism you can track. But for instance, I mean, if Hillary Clinton had really had nixed the election and got it absolutely right in America and got in, nobody would have said it was a populist revolt. And plenty of things she did could satisfy many, many definitions of populist. And the same thing with Remain. You know, I mean, if Remain had won and the referendum, very few people would have said this is a populist backlash. You know?
Well, I agree. It is imprecise, but it is not excluding you from the political debate.
No.
You are described as populist, so no. You know, it is very elastic and very baggy, but it is far preferable to far right.
Yes, far right says that is it.
That says you're beyond the pale. And as I say, I mean, most mainstream politics is actually populist. Populists tend to be the people that take certain aspects of the mainstream, like, you know, fellow citizen favouritism, like suspicion of elites, further than the mainstream. It's almost more of a kind of attitude or a style than a set of policies.
That was Douglas Murray and David Goodhart.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
On to our final section. General elections are meant to produce a government and an opposition, ideally a decent version of both. It seems obvious what government the election will deliver, a Tory one with an increased majority, but what's not clear yet is what opposition there'll be after this election. I'm now joined by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth. So James, you say in your piece that what passes for optimism in Labour at the moment is the sense that Corbyn might be out. Is there any possibility he could stay on afterwards?
Yes, I think there is, because I think if you look at the determination with which they're trying to parachute in his acolytes into safe seats, that shows that they still want to try and kind of control the party. And I think on one count, you need 15% of the parliamentary Labour Party to nominate you to get on the ballot. It is at the moment, 15% of a smaller number of Labour MPs is fewer people. And at the moment, there's a reckon that there's about 26 people who'd nominate Jeremy Corbyn or some other hard left candidate. So add a few more names into the mix and he could get on the ballot again, or another hard left candidate could get on the ballot. I think this is the other thing, though, is even if Labour get rid of Jeremy Corbyn and they elect a kind of more inverted commas moderate leader, that is only the beginning of a long journey back for Labour. This will be a Labour leader who inherits a party that have lost its Scottish strongholds, lost its advantage in Wales, and is having to deal with the fact that the two traditional bits of a Labour base, their interests are diverging in a way that I think is perhaps irreconcilable. The old industrial working class and kind of educated metropolitan liberals, they have very different instincts now. Just look in the EU referendum, you know, Hull and Hampstead voted in very different ways.
Isabel, do you think that's right, that the Labour coalition between metropolitan liberals and the traditional working class are breaking apart and that there's no way of reconciling that?
Yes, and it will be even more difficult when you have fewer MPs. You'll have a small pool of MPs who are fighting one another more viciously about the values that Labour needs to stand for. And as James says, even if the party does get a more moderate leader than Jeremy Corbyn after the election, where's that going to take them back to? What sort of Ed Miliband? Are those now the glory days that the party's harking back to? That was still a catastrophic defeat for Labour in 2015, and so it has a great deal of rebuilding to do. And to go back to Ed Miliband as a sort of good starting point in terms of policies and political pitch is still not a very very optimistic place for the party to be.
James, without a Labour coalition, what's going to fill this vacuum?
Well, I think at the start of this campaign, a lot of people thought, including me, that the Liberal Democrats would have a good election. They have a very clear position on Brexit, unlike the Labour Party. They want a second referendum in which they will campaign for Remain. And one would have thought that would have given them a good chance to pitch that kind of 48% of the country who voted to Remain less than a year ago. Now, I don't think even the most optimistic Brexiteer could claim that a majority of those people are now happy that Britain is leaving the EU. But the start of a Lib Dem campaign has been nothing short of disastrous. Tim Farron's got himself involved in a protracted discussion of the morality of gay sex. They've had the embarrassment of the party selecting, albeit briefly, a parliamentary candidate who Farron had previously said had made anti-Semitic comments. And I get the feeling that this is going to be like 2005 all over again for the Liberal Democrats. In that election, the Iraq War, the dent that had put in Tony Blair's popularity, and the fact that the Tories were led by Michael Howard, who was definitely to the right of where the political mainstream was then, gave the Liberal Democrats an opportunity for a massive breakthrough. In the end, they ran a bad campaign and they only gained 11 seats. I think the Lib Dems will make gains this time round, but I don't think we're going to see them emerging as once again as a kind of third force in British politics in the way that they might have done.
Isabel, how do you think things are looking for the Lib Dems?
Well, as James says, they've had a very bad start to their campaign. And actually, in 2015, we thought their campaign had gone really well, that they'd managed to get attention, even just in terms of sort of picture captions with Nick Clegg going to Go Ape and hedgehog sanctuaries and sort of generally appearing as though he was on some kind of stag do, or it actually turned out to be a weird sort of valedictory tour from him as leader. So that this looks much worse than the picture we had in 2015, and things did not go well for them in 2015. That they do have a completely different pitch now, but there are people who were associated with the coalition who are standing again in certain seats, like Jo Swinson. They've had a few boosts, such as Rachel Johnson joining them. And I suppose that probably appeals quite well to the sort of audience that they're trying to pitch. But what doesn't appeal well to the sort of audience that they're trying to pitch to, as James says, is their leader having to go on and on and on about whether or not he thinks gay sex is a sin, and then a row about anti-Semitism. I think that those are two things that the sort of pro-Remain, young, potentially quite, I don't want to say metropolitan, but liberal audience that they're trying to win back is going to be really put off by those things.
If that audience don't vote for the Lib Dems, who do you think they're likely to go for?
I think this is one of the great questions of this election, which is, you know, where do those pro-Remain voters go? You know, there is some polling evidence that there are Remain voters for whom this is their kind of the key point of their political identity, is that they voted to stay in the EU. Now, the Labour Party are not trying to keep Britain in the EU. They say that they accept the result of the Brexit referendum. So they're not going to go Lib Dem. Where do they go? The Greens are making a bit of a pitch for that vote, I think, in certain places. But I think it is unclear where they go. I mean, it's one of the things about British politics being in flux. And one of the things that Theresa May is benefiting from is that she's been remarkably successful at keeping the Tory coalition together. The seepage of Tory Remainers to Liberal Democrats has been much smaller than you might think. And she's managed to add to that kind of huge chunks of the UKIP vote. And so I think in a way that the Brexit side of the argument in this election is in a much more disciplined and better position than the Remain side.
You say in your piece that normally in these circumstances an internal opposition to the Prime Minister would emerge. Do you see any kind of division along those lines at the moment?
I don't, because I don't see a Gordon Brown style figure in Theresa May's cabinet. You know, those around Theresa May they keep a very watchful eye out for plots, for overmighty ministers, and there is no alternative source of patronage in the Theresa May government. You know, under Gordon Brown, ambitious Labour MPs could sign up with him, and you knew that a certain number of Gordon Brown people would get promoted in every reshuffle, because that was the nature of the deal that he had with Tony Blair. That doesn't exist now. And then I think the other thing is this, is I think Theresa May's own popularity is giving her a kind of weapon to use in internal arguments for her party after the election. You know, look at the fact that she's campaigning in lots of these Labour seats in the north. She's not campaigning as the Conservative Party either. She's Theresa May, strong and stable leadership in the national interest. I think that will enable her to turn around to Tory MPs who are unhappy about some of the more kind of economically interventionist policies she plans to pursue after the election, and say, look, you know, this is what the country voted for. They voted for me and my kind of conservatism.
Just finally, Isabel, do you think it's going to be a problem for the Tories not having a strong opposition?
I think in the long term, yes, because weak oppositions mean that governments can get away with producing rubbish policies, which then can result in the electorate getting very angry with that government. But that's a slow burning issue, because it takes a couple of years for a policy to really feel its effect amongst the public. It takes quite a few months for a bill to get through the House of Commons. So I don't think it's beneficial in the long term for the Tories to have no opposition. But in the short term, they're going to be absolutely loving it, because they will have no opposition trying to drum up stories in the media about the failure of various policies or trying to push for rebellions. As James says, the frustration amongst cabinet ministers over the past few months has been much more about Theresa May not being radical enough, not doing enough of what they want to do on certain policy areas. It's not so much, I hate the direction in which she's taking the party, because they haven't really seen enough of the direction of the party that she wants to go in. And this election, as James says, is all about her saying, now I've got the mandate to do what I want.
That was Jane Forsyth and Isabel Hardman. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And you can also subscribe to our other shows, including our Coffeehouse Shots podcast, where we're providing daily discussions about all the most intriguing stories from the election campaign. And if you enjoy the podcast, then why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as great pieces by Yacenda Maxtone Graham, Theodore Dalrymple and Matt Ridley. And we've got a trial offer. Get 12 issues for just £12 by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.